Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like
you. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close.
Call us toll free, 1-888-429-5471. Join us at any time during the show.
I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet.
And Deidre with us. She's the author of Inner Visions, The Healing Path of Art. She's a psychic life coach, a healer, an artist, a speaker, and a certified angel messenger practitioner. She currently hosts the weekly cable TV show, The Intuitive Millionaire Coach Show. And her first book, again, is The Inner Visions, as a result of following her own intuition. And hi, welcome to the show. Hi, Ann, do we have you?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, good. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. When we talk about psychics, what are we really talking about? Lay a base and a definition of what a psychic is, and then we can work from there.
Absolutely. Well, it's I call it intuition, psychic intuition. There's different levels from my understanding according to how much we can develop our intuition. I lived most of my life not being aware of this gift. So when it was approximately about 7 years ago and began to do some creative work like writing and still following my painting, I began to notice some information that was coming to me that sounded like very good advice. And then what I've discovered since then in terms of psychic, it can mean of the soul. It is an ability to tune into information which I derive from what I call the higher levels. There's a cosmic consciousness. I believe that we're all connected to divine source and the divine mind and the Holy Spirit. There's different names for this. For me, it's an ability to offer myself great wisdom and advice, and that's what I'm able to pass on to my clients. And I've been doing this for several years, and it's something I really rely on now.
Now,
the ability to hear the advice for your life, that's not something you could read or know any other way.
No, by the way, is that something that everybody has inside of them, or is that something that you have to learn?
You know, I do believe that we all have spiritual gifts, and if you become more aware of maybe you're driving down the road and you might have a feeling that you might want to take a right, or you know, if you ever drove past a road and said, "Oh, I thought I should have taken that." So, everybody does have this ability of kind of having this inner navigation, but whether we listen to it or not is another thing, and we absolutely can develop it. That's something that I have done, and I do help other people with it.
Now, you were going through bouts of depression, and most people go through depression, and they have no idea how to get out of it. They take pills. They go to doctors. But for you, your intuition was the healing factor to let you move through the depression. How was that for you?
Well, I did suffer from depression for over a decade, and I was on many different medications for depression and anxiety, and I did receive a diagnosis that I would suffer from depression for the rest of my life, and I didn't question it. I felt like I had things going on which seemed depressing at the time, and I accepted the diagnosis, if you will.
Sure.
However, I was going through a difficult situation in my life and a new job, and the stress became so great that I ended up walking out on the greatest, highest-paying job I had ever had, and I knew that there was something in trouble. I'd always been able to at least take care of myself. So I felt it was debilitating at that point. I received more medication and continued to feel increasingly worse. Mm. Now, what happened was I went to a local health food store. I really had found it difficult to leave the house. It was really a very debilitating depression. I did manage to go to a health food store. I found a magazine there. I think it was called Sacred Pathways, and there was an article in there that said Receiving the Divine. I saw a picture of Yogananda, who was an ascended master, who I know that now. I didn't know who it was. And I saw a picture of Norman Paulson, who had studied with Yogananda, and there was this article about Kriya Yoga meditation. And I thought, you know, Receiving the Divine sounds really good about now. So I ordered the DVD and the book, and I practiced it. It was a very simple meditation. I'd heard about meditating. It was something I didn't think I could do. But it was kind of a sink or swim situation, so I said, I'm really going to give this meditation a try here. And I did. And within, I would say, a month, I began to notice. Now, I've been a painter for 20 years. I didn't think anything of it. I saw, like, in my mind's eye, like in your imagination, which you can call clairvoyance, a psychic channel, I saw a picture of this book, Inner Visions. I saw one of my paintings, Sunrise, and I saw words around it. And I thought, that looks like a book. And I thought, I heard this information inside me, like, you're going to write a book. And I followed that guidance, Michael. I went into my living room. I ended up getting a notebook, and I had all of a sudden an understanding that if I started writing just the first line, which I did, suddenly for the next 6 weeks, I was actually writing a book. So that moved me out of my depression.
As a feeling then. It started out then as a feeling, just that inside, that gut feeling that we talk about, that you're going to write a book. You just knew that's what it was and followed it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Most of us have that, but you know what happens? That based on our behavior, based on our experience, we talk ourselves out of it. It's that allowing yourself to let go, because the person who knows the best for you is who's inside of you, and most of us won't allow that to happen.
Yes, we do have blocks, absolutely.
Okay, now you talk about something about, well, let's go to accessing that intuition. What is it? Are there steps to do so?
Absolutely. In fact, I just finished writing my second book, I have to say, and it'll be out in a month. So I just went through this process again. It's been 7 years, but it's absolutely marvelous to say, I'm going to write another book and sit down and do it. It's the sitting down and doing it part. But yes, the meditation was first and foremost. Again, I felt like I had to do something, and that definitely worked for me. What I realize now, and I didn't know anything about meditation, but bringing the breath up through the spine, clearing out the energy, I guess stuck energy. What I realize now is depression is a bit of stuck energy in some of the chakras. I've learned a lot since all this has happened. And bringing that energy up and moving it, and bringing it out through the crown or the top of my head and moving this energy through my body helped allow me the energy from spirit, God source, to come through our spiritual centers, the chakras, seven spirits, main spiritual centers in our body, which I work with people now to clear, because this meditation brought the breath up and did clear some of my energy centers. So that did work. And then energetically, I have learned to realize through my own study of the law of attraction and what has worked for me and my clients is that there are some things that you can do, like intend it. I've learned that we have free will, and which is a wonderful gift, and we can take that free will and we can say an affirmation, which I've done for the past 7 years. I say, I intend to align my will with my intuition, my higher self, depending on the day. Maybe I'll say, Holy Spirit. I'll say, align my will with my intuition. To me, that's giving that power, allowance to come through. I may still hear an ego choice, but I'm aware that I have another choice at the same time. So that's intention. And then one other really good way is downtime. Now, I'm a highly creative person at this point where I can be very disciplined and sit down. I can write several articles, publish them. I can do it like clockwork, like you said, the sitting down part. But I allow myself the time where I will turn off the television. I will shut off my cell phone, and I become available for these ideas and inspirations to come through me. So it's almost like I have an appointment called God's Spirit. Okay, I'm ready to write right now. So
let me hold you up for a minute. You said something very important. You said something about choice early on. And I think that's really the key. Mm-hmm. There are internal choices that if we're not aware of those choices, we obviously won't make the choice, and it could lead our life in any kind of a direction you could possibly imagine. So I really believe when it comes down to it, it's listening to yourself. We're running out of time fairly soon, but let me ask you this one question. And I think it's important for everybody. You talk about finding your life's purpose. There's so many people who go through life. You know, you're born, you go through life, and you're muddling your way through, you're wandering through your way through, have no idea what the end result is, and most people just die and for whatever happens to them. But what are you talking about when you say life's purpose? How do you zero in on that?
One of the greatest questions that I ask people is, what have you struggled with? What we learn, we teach. Now, I would not be able to sleep at night thinking about, what am I supposed to do for my purpose? And how can I stop taking everybody else's advice and listen? I didn't feel like I had intuition. So here I am teaching intuition and life purpose because I struggled with it so much. Some people I work with struggle with self-love. Then they come to give workshops and teach other women and men how to love themselves. So they've struggled with things. So what we learn, we teach. That's a big clue. Another great thing is, joy is your roadmap. These things that we, even if we don't think we're good at things. Now, I was an average student, C student. I wasn't good at art. I'm now a professional artist and a professional writer. So I realized at some point that I just enjoyed it, and it didn't matter if anybody else thought I was good enough. So whatever you enjoy, cooking, decorating, follow your joy. Maybe you'll be on the Food Network because you throw some extra spices, and pay attention to what you're good at. And you know, this is easier than you thought, or lose track of time. Those kinds of things are great clues to your purpose. Again, you said we tend to dismiss them or not think of them as important. I had a whole lot of artwork just sitting in a pile collecting dust until I got this intuition, said, get your artwork together. You're going to write a book about it. So we may not think much of these things that we enjoy, but those are great clues to what our purpose is. If you like to help people and talk to people, then you know, you'd be a good counselor. So whatever our natural gifts and talents are, pay attention to those things.
No, well, man, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the books, and follow along with what you're doing?
Oh, that would be great. I have a newsletter where I offer tips monthly on intuition, all kinds of things. It's called Your Prosperous Life Kit. I have a special report there on ways to know if you're living your life purpose, and an original art angel wing print that I did. You'd receive a copy of that. And my website is annedeidre.com. So it's AnnedeIdre.
Wonderful. AnnedeIdre, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. And realistically, if more people would listen to them, their selves, they wouldn't have a lot of the problems that they have.
Yes, I appreciate this time with you, Michael, very much. Thank you. Thank you to the listeners.
Good night. Good night.
To you and me, I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. To be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm them in a night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Keith Elkins with us, and he is a celebrated martial arts expert, corporate trainer, and a motivational speaker. He's also developed social programs for at-risk youth and the Pony Principles. The Pony Principles, that's his first book. And let's say, Keith, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when you talk about the Pony Principles, let's start out with where the name came from, and we'll work our way through. So the Pony Principles, where did the name come from?
Well, it came from when I was growing up. You know, I'm the oldest of three boys, and we were raised by the same parents, same environment, same everything. And, you know, my brothers were in and out of jail, you know, involved with drugs and a lot of negative activities, ended up dropping out of school. So when people would find out that we were actually related, they, you know, I would always say, I've always been looking for the pony, as if it's your birthday and you think you're going to get a pony, that, you know, attitude of optimism and positive focus. So that's really based on the title is based on that specifically.
Okay, now the guts of it, though, when you really got into it, what was that core message? What was that certain something you wanted people to know?
The core message is really that, you know, the power of focus, that no matter what's going on, you don't lose the lesson. Adversity is, and pain sometimes are our greatest teachers, and those are the things that we remember the most. So you don't lose a lesson, and whatever you focus on expands. So very often, especially in today's economy and with the gloom and doom and, you know, what you see on the front page, that's all we focus on, and that's what expands in our lives. So the core message is, you know, you can change that. You don't have to let the world around you dictate what your destiny is or how successful you are in life.
I think one of the most important things so far is the ability to focus. Martial arts training does that, and I wish they would have some kind of martial arts training, starting in the grammar schools, working all the way up, because it does. There's a discipline that kids, I think, and most people don't have today. We run our lives frightened to death of what happens if we take this step, what happens if we take that step. And I really believe the major question is, since fear runs the majority of our lives, how do you move through fear and feel comfortable enough to know you're going to be okay on the other end of it?
Well, again, we have to realize fear is an energy, just like happiness, excitement, anger, or anything else. And it's really up to us to focus on how we take that energy, even though we may think of it as a negative energy, and harness it so that it propels us into a more successful and focused direction. We all go through fear. You know, that's a constant. You know, you can look at excitement as a form of fear. But I've always said that fear is almost like everybody gets butterflies. And some people get butterflies and they're flying all over the place. and then other people get butterflies, but they've taught them how to fly in formation. And to me, that's the message there, that to use fear as an energy and redirect it into a positive direction.
Okay, so fear, in essence, is an indicator. It's a warning sign for something, and it doesn't mean that you have to fall down. It doesn't mean you have to hide from everything, but it's an indicator of something. Someone once gave me a great, great definition of fear. What the definition was is fear is you're worried that they'll hit you back harder. And I think really that's what it comes down to. And when people go through life with their fear, it's not maybe fear that they've developed themselves. It's fear that they've been taught from someone else's opinion of how things would go. They're not willing. People are not willing to step outside, quote unquote, the box and get away from those behaviors that they were taught by someone else to realize that life is okay and it's okay to be who you are. And if you want to make it, you can.
Well, you know, I'm just as proactive and out of the box as everybody else, but I try to tell the people that I work with, the workshops that I do, the staff that I work with, you have to focus on the box before you can really get out of the box. So, you know, what is your formula for how to redirect fear and how you condition yourself to even think about it? And, you know, is it always a negative, or is it something that pushes you in the direction that you need to go? So that phrase, being out of the box all the time, I think is very important, but we still need to focus on the box.
Okay, I think that, yeah, and you're right, the box is extremely important, there's no question about it, but inside the box is usually the same thoughts, everybody thinks pretty much the same thoughts, you scramble them up, they're going to come out a little different way, and a great definition of thinking out of the box is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And I think that's probably the best definition of thinking outside the box, getting away from all of those guidelines that you've taught yourself. One of the ways that I learned, well, not one of the ways, the way I learned to eliminate fear many years ago had to do with a horse. I had the horse, and every time it was cinch bound, every time I'd saddle it up, the horse would rear up, go over, back, and down. Put a fear in me, Keith, that I just could not get rid of no matter what I did. I became afraid of horses. So the trainer got me into what's called a round pen, and I would have this little whip, and I would have a rope, and the horse would run around in circles, and I would chase the horse, and the horse would run, and I chase the horse, and I would get so out of breath and so wiped out, and the trainer would keep pushing me till I was so tired, the fear went away. And the one thing I learned at that point was, if I ever get frightened, I get physical. And for some reason, if you get physical enough, the fear will go away and allow you to think.
Well, absolutely. Just going back to, and I was excited to hear you say that it would be nice to have martial arts programs or martial arts-based programs in grammar in middle school and high school, because that kinetic piece, which has been taken away from children in schools, they don't get that like they used to, and now everybody has the condition of the month, whether it's you know, ADHD or ADD or ABC or XYZ, that kinetic piece is definitely a link, and that's why, again, in my martial arts profession, it's been so powerful when it comes to parents bringing their students to us in my business to focus all of that. If I can go into basically one of the reasons that I talk about fear is the first time I ever went skydiving, and I went with a group of martial arts instructors that I worked with early in the beginning of my career, actually, and we got up in the plane. We were 3,000 square feet, and I looked out the window, and I said, wow, you know, the ground looks just like pictures in a book. Everything looks miniature, and all my friends looked at me and said, well, you act like you've never been in a plane before, and I failed to tell them in advance I'd never been in a plane before. So they proceeded to tell me, well, you're crazy. I mean, the first time you go up in a plane, you're going to jump out of it. So I tried to redirect that with them, and I said, well, you've been in planes before. And they're like, yes. And I said, but you never jumped out of one. And they're like, no. I said, so are you scared right now? And they're like, yes. Okay, well, you've flown in a plane. I haven't. We're both scared, so we're pretty much in the same boat. So it just, again, redirecting your perspective on fear and conditions and turning that into a productive and positive and proactive approach.
But doesn't fear, you know, another aspect of us, of it, when you get into a place when you think you quote unquote can't handle it. Now I'm 5'8", I weigh about 160 pounds, and if a guy about 6'7" walked up to me and weighed 300 pounds and said, "I'm gonna break your nose," he would scare me. But at the same time, if a guy 5'1" walked up to me and said, "You're gonna break my nose," you're not gonna scare me. So I think really when we're dealing with fear, we're dealing with what we don't think we can move our way through, what we don't think we can't conquer or accomplish. I really believe that's what it comes down to. And if you allow yourself to focus, as you're saying, and believe in yourself, there's so many things that you can do that you didn't think you could do.
Well, I mean, that goes back to that old core instinct of fight or flight. But, you know, I have a little twist on that. And animals, it's fight or flight. There's no in between. But we're analytical. We have a tendency to analyze or overanalyze every situation. So, you know, we have that fight or freeze situation. So because we overthink or over-question or overanalyze or self-sabotage, we have a tendency to freeze our ability to take any action.
Well, and no question about it. And effectively what we're doing is we're talking yourself out of it. And we talk about people being linear, okay, left brain. You know, you're dealing with anything with fight or flight. It happens to be brain chemistry. You know, you walk into a room, you see somebody that reminds you of somebody that you were afraid of, you didn't like, and some adrenaline starts to hit, and you go into that fight or flight. In your mind, you escape. Or you walk into the room, see somebody else who you really like, and you get a shot of dopamine. Now, all of a sudden, you're feeling good about it. And I really believe when you're talking about focus, you're also talking about the ability to control your brain chemistry, which controls your mood and your attitude. And if you think you can't, Keith, I know you believe in this, you can't. But if you know you can, and you know that there's obstacles, and you know you have the ability to move through those obstacles, you get through and the fear will diminish itself.
Well, I completely agree. One of the most important quotes I use in some of my trainings and workshops is, obstacles are not there to obstruct you, they're there to instruct you.
Absolutely.
If you look at that adversity as, you know, it's no difference in the vocabulary that you use, the words that you use. As we all know, body language is about 58% of human communication. But vocabulary is important. Words do matter. And it's no different than when you say on one side, "I have a problem." Some people use that term. And then another person, they use the word challenge. Well, if you look in the dictionary at the definition of both of them, they're pretty much identical. But if you ask how people in a room that you're speaking to, ask them how they feel about each word, they feel better about the word challenge. So that's something that we have to condition ourselves to as well, as the vocabulary that we use when we're talking about these things.
Oh, I completely agree, because when you're dealing with vocabulary, if I say to you, chamber a round, do you know what that means?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I saw the flash go in your head. You just saw it a bit. But if somebody doesn't know what that means, and they don't have a mental image for it, they don't have a picture of it, and then if I were to say put a bullet in a gun, the bullet is the round, the chamber is where you stick it. Now there's a mental image, and we're on the same page. And that's exactly what you were talking about, because I say it does not mean that you have heard it the way that I meant it, because the images may be completely different. If I say, if you think of, here's a better way to exemplify what you're saying. If I say car, what kind of a car do you see in your mind?
The one that I drive.
Okay, you see the color, the style, and everything?
Absolutely.
Okay, now, for me, and I don't know why, but the last couple of months, when I use this example, what comes up for me, and this is our secret, we won't tell anybody because it's going to age me, was the very first car that I ever owned, which was a blue 1950 Studebaker. The point here is this. The point here is this, that with one word, you and I saw two completely different images. And for us to be able to communicate, we've got to see the same image based on what's being said.
Absolutely, and it goes back to painting pictures and storytelling, especially when you're working with people. I tell everybody when I'm working with a group, there could be 200 different people in the room. I can't be focused on their perception of what I'm saying because they're going to receive me differently.
Sure.
I'm never really totally in charge of my reputation because of that perception, but I am in charge of my character and my message. And I can make sure that I deliver the best message with the belief system that I have. But I agree with you in reference to it depends on people's personal experiences and their
yes.
conditioning.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And I really believe one of the things that this thought flashed by when a moment ago, when we're talking about having the martial arts, having the discipline in the grammar schools, junior high schools, high schools, there's a reason for that because martial arts also teaches consequence. If you don't do a particular thing, XYZ is going to happen to you. And I think one of the things that is missing in the schools today, the kids aren't learning consequence. Because if you get out of school, you go on to whatever education that you're going to go on to, the big problem is this. If you live your life and have learned that consequence is not part of your entire world, how are you going to deal in the world of the workplace? There is consequence. You don't do what the boss says, you get fired. And what are you going to do? Sue him? Today's world? Yes.
Well, I mean, I think we've raised a couple of generations of young people that feel entitled. You know, this is owed to me. I should get it no matter what you ask. I actually run a program which is a behavior coaching program called Connections in an alternative school in the school district that I live in. And when I work with groups of kids, and what's bizarre, because I own a business and I have for many years, when I say to them, if you agree to work a job and that job is 9 to 5, what time in the morning do you show up? And very often they'll say 9 o'clock. And I'm like, no, you've missed the whole concept. That work ethic, consequences, all of those things, I agree with you, Mike. It's almost a lost art form, and it's something that sure. we really need to get back to.
We're running out of time, but I'll give you the biggest change that we've had. Can you imagine, go back to when you were 12, 13 years old. Can you imagine walking into your house and using a four-letter expletive to your mother or father?
I couldn't imagine it on the way home because then the neighbors would tell. If I got home, they would call my parents and say, you know, I heard Keith say this, this, and this. So, no, not at all.
Because, see, that's the key. That's the difference in the culture and responsibility and everything else. The hair on the back of my neck stands up when I even think of something like that. That's not today. So I think what you're doing and what you're teaching has, you know, is going right to the heart of it, and I hope more and more people get involved in what you have to offer. The book, again, is The Pony Principles, Keith Elkins. Keith, is there a website we can find you at?
The publisher website is outskirtspress.com/The Pony Principles, and it's also available on Amazon.com.
Keith, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Go get them. I think you're doing a wonderful job. I love what you've got to offer.
I appreciate you. All right. Live out loud, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're away. Got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know
now some of these days.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Delia Horowitz, Paula Benalt with us. They are the co-authors of Collaboration Soup, a six-step recipe for co-creative meetings and other conversations. They are professional meeting facilitators specializing in promoting productivity in business, nonprofits, and community groups. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. Thank you. This is Paula, and this is Delia's voice.
Hey. Oh, hey, Paula, did I pronounce your last name right? I took a shot at it.
Pretty good, pretty good.
Okay, well, pronounce it for me just to make sure we got it, and I'll never make a mistake again.
It's either Vignault or Vigneault. Okay.
Vigneault, which one do you like?
I like Vigneault.
Vigneault it is from this point forward and forever. Okay.
That's very French.
Okay, by the way, collaboration is a very interesting word. Because I have found over the years that one of the hardest things that people can have is to collaborate, to get on the same page and move in the same direction and focus on the same end result. How do you get through that madness that you run into every time you're going to go into a group and get them to focus and end up in one direction?
Boy, that's the big question. That's really why we wrote the book, because we were feeling so frustrated ourselves at going to meetings where people really wanted to try to find solutions together, and there was a lot of talent in the room, but we would leave and tear our hair out, and that's how the book got written. We said, oh my gosh, if they only knew a few things that we knew! And then we decided to put them into a book and to help people implement the things that they need to come together the way people are wanting to come together, you know? Well, all of us want solutions. And
Okay, let me ask you this. I know we all want solutions to things. We want to be on the same page. And I think one of the things that you guys do talk about, and it's very important, let's go to a place that, you know, comes to the heart of all that matters and affects everybody on the planet. Basically, Congress, when we look at Congress, if you were to have, the both of you were to have the proverbial magic wand and you were queens of Congress, what would you do to cause Congress to be able to wake up and do what they're supposed to do?
Well, first of all, I'd make sure they knew that it was all in their heads.
I mean, I love the idea of being a queen of Congress.
Wow!
Yes.
But the point of it is right now Congress is in an adversarial perspective. When people are in an adversarial perspective or think somebody else is the enemy, they're not in their right mind. There's a collaborative part of the brain in the upper brain. There's the amygdala that puts us into, oh my gosh, you're going to kill me, so I have to kill you first. And in fact, we've got a free article on the website for people to explain what happens with the brain so that people can take charge of that. Because you can't collaborate when you're in the amygdala lizard brain and thinking that, you know, somebody's going to die and it ain't going to be me.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There's no question about it. I think the biggest problem that Congress has today, if you go back 10 years, 12 years maybe, what you found was a Congress that would get in and they would battle, they would go head-to-head, and then they'd go out and have lunch, have dinner, they were friends. I think what we have today is such a separation that it's not about right and wrong. It's going to be about who's going to win. They don't go in with values neutral and express the will of the people. They're supposed to be a reflection of you and I, and that's not what's happening right now. So what do you think it'll get to get them on that same path? Because the way it looks right now is even in the media, there's a confusion between news and quote-unquote what people think entertainment is. So you've got that confusion going on constantly. So what you two are offering is not necessarily the answer to just meetings and nonprofits and so on and so forth. You can go right to the guts of how this country is run, and you find that same problem to fix.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the book is that there are situations where collaboration won't work. And it won't work if two parties, whether it's Congress or people in a meeting, are more committed to their position and being right about their position than coming together to find common ground together. That's what it really takes, are the people that are willing to do that. And, you know, a great example is the reason that we started having a nuclear peace treaty is because Reagan and Gorbachev took a walk together at Camp David and showed each other pictures of their grandchildren. This is a true story, Michael. They showed each other pictures of their grandchildren, and when they did that, they agreed that they wanted a world that their grandchildren could grow up in. There's always common ground, and Congress can find common ground if they just have a couple of simple mechanisms to get to the heart of things and realize they wouldn't care so much. They wouldn't be so... I'm going to be careful the word I use right now. But they're passionate because they care. And they need to focus on what they care about together, their shared goal and vision and purpose, that they're here to serve the people and not for their own pocket lining.
Now, by the way, when you say shared goal and vision, I think where the biggest problem is, and you said pocket lining, and they're not all like that, but predominantly we run into that. There's no question there are people bought and sold there all the time. You take, you know, for years, you know, administrations come and go, presidents come and go, Congresses come and go. But what stays constant is business, because what business does, business is true to their core, and their core is their bottom line in to create money. And what we have found, this is all about money. So what you are offering, you should put into the president's lap right now, because I think what's going on is we're getting destroyed because we are getting separated here. At this stage of the game, you've got Republicans against Democrats, you've got men against women, you've got women against women, you've got blacks against white, Hispanics against, I mean, this, the list goes on and on and on. And there is where we need, quote unquote, collaboration. We need a common ground that we can all work from.
Absolutely. And the way that a lot of that starts is in our communities. It starts in our neighborhoods. It starts in our families. And it starts kind of from the ground up. You know, there's a whole political machinery that's in place that, you know, I'm not a politician, but from my perspective, it looks like it's very entrenched in keeping the status quo. When we talk about people coming together to solve complex problems, it really is going to take people to step out of themselves, out of their ordinary, you know, day-to-day, and really come together to make a commitment to solve these common problems. For example, the belief that we've all had that you shouldn't talk politics at the dinner table is wrong. We should be talking politics at the dinner table. And, you know, we wrote the book in the form of a recipe with six very simple steps. And what people need to do is invite people to dinner and say, I want us to have a conversation to find out what we agree on and what we can do to have a positive effect in Congress. Number one, the R of our recipe, get ready for the conversation. And they should listen deeply, not to debate or to argue, although that's a great skill,
But let's start listening to each other about what really matters, just like Reagan and Gorbachev did with showing each other pictures of their grandchildren. We need to take back our democracy. Citizens are doing exactly what Congress is doing. We're making them the enemy and us the good guy. And we need to realize, Michael, we're all in this together. The solutions are there, and the solutions lie in the conversations, and the way people engage in conversations is not been effective. And that's what we are passionate about, is helping people, showing people simple steps they can do to get beyond the conflicts, embrace the conflicts, and move together towards common solutions and what we all want.
Now, by the way, you said the magic words earlier. You said political machine. A machine is not human. And as long as we have a machine running things there, we're not going to get that human touch that you're talking about that I would so dearly love to have. Also, I came from a world that politics was always politics, but nothing like it's moved to today. And you're right. Unless we do something about it, we are not going to be who we were. We're not going to be who we think we're going to become. We're going to become something completely different. And it's very scary at this point unless people start to do what you're talking about doing. From the ground up and from the up down to the ground.
And kind of on the note of business, you know, you're talking about the bottom line of business, you know, is for profit. And, you know, yes, that's true. And there are many new kinds of businesses that are formed. There's actually a new legal status of business called the benefit corporation. And they are corporations that build into their articles of incorporation very specific measures for social good. So it isn't just, you know, giving some extra money to a nonprofit if I have enough money at the end of the year. It's really being committed to social change. And I'm not talking about socialism. I'm talking about people getting together and really deciding what it is we want, what kind of world, you know, what kind of country, what kind of community, what kind of neighborhood do I want to live in and be part of.
You see, well, we've got to get beyond, there's an interesting word here that comes into play, not necessarily with groups and organizations, but politically is what we're being faced with today. It's a very interesting word. I don't even like to use the word, and I think this is probably the first time I've thought of it this way, but there's something called hate out there. And unless we diminish that, unless we put that in a closet someplace or bury it and allow people to move through, because I'm white and somebody else is black, there's no reason we should be hating each other. And it's not because I or that person did. It's because what somebody said to maneuver people into a particular political position whereby somebody's going to benefit. That's really what it boils down to.
And you know what gets people beyond hate? Looking in each other's eyes. Being close enough to smell each other.
Yeah.
De-demonizing each other.
Yeah.
And people who are coming together when they have differences don't understand how to get beyond those differences to their similarities. And again, that's the steps that we teach. It's not that complicated.
No, too simple. And when it really comes down to it, what you're saying is you'll never get an argument out of me about that. I'm on your side.
But a lot of people really want to get beyond the hate, and they don't know how. And again, that's what you're about, and that's what we're about, is helping people get beyond the hate and go from being sad to being optimistic. And being involved and engaged. And that's what democracy is. Democracy is about engaging. Democracy is structured for conflict. And it's in the conflict, it's in the differences between us that we find the truth.
Absolutely. I came from a world, I was brought up in a world where we didn't lock our doors. And when we came home or walked down the street, we didn't worry about somebody jumping out of a car and beating our brains out. I don't know anybody who carried a gun, et cetera, so on and so forth. You know, it was a very innocent world compared to what it is now. That doesn't mean there weren't problems. And doesn't mean that there weren't things festering politically that would cause, you know, world problems. But it's got to a point now that if somebody doesn't stop and take a look at it and get close enough, look in somebody's eyes, reach out there and touch. This is the problem we're having today. Let me put it in a nutshell. I was 8 years old, and I was in my bedroom. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the door was open. The phone rang. It was my mom answered the phone. My brother was there. My dad had been in the hospital, and he passed away, and I heard my mother getting the message, and I saw her cry. And I did not let her know that I knew. And so I got to school that day, and the teacher saw that I was visibly upset. She took me into the cloakroom, and I told her what happened. I started crying, and she put her arms around me, and she hugged me. She could not have done a better thing for me that day. I mean, I needed that so bad. But do you know what would happen today if you did that? You'd get sued.
Yeah.
You'd go to jail. Yeah. And see, that's what we're missing today.
But also, Michael, we have to learn not to rely on the schools and the government and the bureaucracy. We need to bring the conversations into our neighborhood. We're starting, for example, in our community, you know, we've got a potluck going every week where we're trying to meet the neighbors. So in case of emergency, we know each other. The best emergency preparedness you can do is to know your neighbors. We live in the happiest city in North America, supposedly.
And where is that?
San Luis Obispo, California.
I love San Luis Obispo. I went through there 100 years ago, and we're right by, where is it? Hearst Castle.
Yes.
What
Come on
place.
Down and visit us. We have lots of collaborative circles going on, lots of conversations here. Collaboration is kind of a way of life here. At least we're trying to make it so.
Wait, how's this? And what are you going to feed me?
What do you think, darling? We're going to feed you soup. You can even help us make it. But, you know, coming together to solve the world's problems is a lot like coming together for a potluck. Everybody brings what they have, and that's, of course, the stone soup fable that our book uses as a metaphor, is everybody brings what little they have, and together we've got enough for all of us.
Okay, but if you got bagels there, then I'm coming.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of that, Michael.
If you have bagels there, I'll come.
And cream cheese and lox. Yeah, such a deal.
I got it. Oh, I heard
actually, the first cover of our book, when we were writing it, we were looking on Google Images for just a temporary book cover, and we found three grandmothers in a kitchen, you know, making soup, and that was kind of our first working cover just for our own ha-has.
No, I think it's great. Guys, we're running out of time. Let me ask this website we can find you at, get the book, and find out the things that you're doing.
Well, and also we do have a free article people can download about the brain and how they can create the conditions for people to bring their best to the meeting or conversation or whatever. It's www.collaborationsoup.com. There's free resources on there. There's a newsletter that's called A Taste of Soup and lots of resources for people, and we're glad to help.
Wonderful. And if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website to follow up on. Both of you, I want to thank you so much for your time. I love what you're doing. Go out and, as my grandmother would say, my Jewish grandmother would say, go kick some posterior, get this thing done.
Thank you, Michael, for all you do. You're a positive force in the world.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Some of these days you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. Oh,
'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so fast. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. It's called Wake Up, Business Leaders. It's time to get real. The book is Get Real Leadership, a practical approach that delivers relationships, respect, and results. Harry Campbell is our guest. And Harry, hi, welcome to the show. I almost heard you. Did we have a glitch there in the sound?
Oh, I'm sorry. I just said thanks for having me.
Oh, and you're welcome very much. Now, by the way, we talk about leadership. Let's start from scratch. When we talk about get real, are we really exposed to what we would call real leadership today? And I don't mean politically, but just, you know, through business, through the ranks of organizations, et cetera, do they really know what real leadership is?
Michael, I think the fair answer is some do and a lot don't. It's one of the reasons why I decided to write the book. I had a chance to be influenced and be around Sam Walton for about a year and a half when I was early on in my career, and I saw what real leadership looked like. And frankly, I've seen the opposite a lot too. And so I think a lot more people need to get back to being authentic and real in order to be effective leaders.
Yeah, and I really think when we come down to it, leadership is not something, Harry, that's innate in all of us. Yes, there's something inside somebody that could possibly allow them to be a leader, but leadership is it's a learned skill. It's not something that you can just go in and have.
I completely agree. In fact, if you don't pay attention to it in terms of being a skill that can be developed, I think you'll miss out. And I think there's a lot of people that are actually in jobs where they're in charge and they're managing, but they're not leading because they don't recognize that, Michael.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. And leaders in and of themselves, you know, there are people, I'm sure you've been exposed to the Peter Principle, the great salesperson that's a great salesperson, and promoted is a good word. Yes, they're a great salesperson and they're promoted to management and they're an okay manager, and then they've been there long enough and they get promoted to an executive and they're a lousy executive, an okay manager, and a great salesperson. They hit that height of incompetency. It's not that they're incompetent, but it's the incompetency of the position that they're trying to fill, and they don't have what it takes to do so.
I have a simple statement with regard to that. I agree, and I say, ouch. Happens all too often. And I think, frankly, that's in many instances, it's actually the fault of the person promoting them because they don't necessarily get what a leader is. I've been a very senior officer, top two or three officer to Fortune 400 company, and I've had peers that frankly felt like the technical expertise they had in the group that they were in was more important than the idea of communicating and leading a group. And when you have thousands of people in your group, you're not it's not necessary and expected that you know everything. It's expected that you lead.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the key. The leader does not have to know everything, but the leader has got to, male or female, the leader has got to be able to put the people around them that can accomplish that. That's the leader's job. The leader is that center, that nucleus that causes everything to happen through the efforts and the accomplishments and the professional ability of those that are chosen to back up and support whatever the goal is.
Amen. And in Get Real Leadership, the book, what I lay out is three ways that I think people can do that, and that's to really think about leading themselves, leading people, and leading the business, and all of those very distinct areas. And if you really try to be authentic and pay attention to all of them, I think you have a much better chance of being wildly successful. It's not just being a better leader. The goal is to win. The goal is to compete, and the goal is to drive passion for your people, and if you do that, you can.
Yeah, but you said something very important. You've got to be able to, number one, lead yourself. If you cannot lead yourself, you can't lead anybody else. And I really believe it starts with the leader. The strength of the leader is going to either diminish the group around him or it's going to build them up. And if this leader's got it within him, the group will get like that. But if the leader doesn't have it, what they're going to get is a diminished effort.
I completely agree. That's the foundation of my thoughts in the book that I have, is that you have to lead yourself first, because, frankly, no one's going to pay attention to you if you're leading the business and your actions don't match your words or your integrity isn't rock solid. You have to lead yourself. I think of it as personal branding, and you have to figure out how strong your personal brand is, whether you understand your personal brand, how people perceive you, how you want to be perceived, and how you can be effective. And if you don't have that, Michael, I'm telling you, the rest of it doesn't matter, because people are going to walk away from you. They're not going to follow you.
No, absolutely. You know, one of the things in all of the years I've done everything that I've ever done, what I have found as regards to branding can't come from you. It can't come from me. It can't come from, you know, the internet guru that's the branding professional. The branding comes from the people around you. It comes from the people who are your customers, the people who you work with, and you get the overarching themes of what they see based on what you do, and that's where the brand comes from.
I completely agree. I grew up at Procter & Gamble. I spent 7 years in marketing there right out of school, and they would say something very simple. They don't make toothpaste. They make Crest, because it has its own attributes. And those attributes aren't coming from Cincinnati. They're helped and aided and communicated. But frankly, it's the customers and the retailers that define that in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. No question about it. And I really believe it's like, you know, like him, dislike him. Steve Jobs. Jobs himself. His brand was Steve Jobs. He was his brand.
Yes,
but
was.
That was the key. Yeah, that was the key. And a brand in and of itself can be a simple. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what I like to do, and I started doing this 15 years ago, is say that everybody has seven words that define them. You can use a higher or lower number. It doesn't matter. I chose seven. It's easy to come up with three or four words to describe somebody in general. It's hard to get five, six, and seven, and I love that. You should know what the world describes you with the seven. You need to know what you believe your seven are. You need to understand the gap between the two. And it is impossible to lead yourself unless you know your personal brand and know how you're viewed by the people that know you best. And if you can find that out anonymously, you are in good shape, because you have the opportunity then to do it right.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really believe when, you know, you ask people what they're selling, and for the most part, I will usually hear 99 out of 10% of the time, I'm selling myself. That you can't bring yourself home to somebody. They don't take you with them. It's what you represent. And when it really comes down to it, people are very involved in themselves. If you ask anybody in an audience what their favorite subject is, it's me, not Michael, but, you know, I'm me, the audience. And in essence, when they can see themselves through you, then all of a sudden it starts to happen, because that's where the key is. It's not about It's like this. It's like get real leadership. I'll do this rhetorically. If I were to say to you, Harry, what's the book about? And if you would have said to me, hypothetically, well, it's a practical approach that delivers relationships, respect, and results. But if I became Harry and somebody said, what's my book about? My answer would be very simple. It's about you.
I love that. It's about how you can be more effective and you can be a leader. And by the way, leader to me has nothing to do with whether you're on org chart, whether you have direct reports, and where you are in an organization. You can be a leader as an individual contributor. You can lead people beside you. You can lead your peers. Frankly, you can lead your boss.
Sure.
But it really has to do with the impact and the influence that you have. And I make that point all the time when I talk to students, when I talk to senior execs and middle managers.
Yeah. No, absolutely, and there's no question about it. And I think if we, you know, we almost had it. And I think what's going on today, we've gotten just lost in this myriad of messages, and people are frightened to death to make a move because of what might happen to them. I mean, this list goes on and on. And if we could just move through that, if we get that point whereby you can go out there and lead and do everything you're going to do and not have to worry about if you say the wrong thing or look at somebody wrong, you're going to get sued or thrown in jail. I think that in and of itself is a hindrance to real, true leaders and performers.
I completely agree. You said something that I want to go back to that I love, and it had to do with sales. One of those truisms in life these days is a lot of people will say that are young and coming up in their careers that they don't want to be in sales. They feel a little bit wrong about that. And my statement to that, Michael, is, folks, everything is sales.
Yeah.
It isn't good or bad, but at the end of the day, you may be selling an idea. You may be selling yourself as a brand. You may be selling to try to get a job. There's a lot of instances where sales is critical and leadership is critically important if you're going to be a salesperson.
Sure. If you want to define sales, sales is offer and acceptance. If you're married, you said to your wife, will you marry me? You made an offer. She could have said yes or no. If she said yes, she got sold. And, I mean, it's that simple.
Well, when I had it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, one of the simplest things I learned from Sam Walton, which was wild, he was the first time I'd heard about servant leader. Sam really defined his organization so that if you were in a job and you had a group, your job was to make the group's work easier, not the inverse. So you had to be a servant leader. That doesn't mean you didn't have to make tough decisions and you weren't in charge. In fact, you were. But servant leadership says, how am I going to make the people around me better? And I talk about this in Get Real Leadership. If you do that, Michael, great people want to work with you, which makes your job easier, and you're more likely to be successful. It's a crazy positive circle.
No question. And as a matter of fact, if more people would begin to realize that, it's okay. You know, we're so hard-pressed in business today. Look at all the competition. It's global competition. People are forced to do much more with so much less time. And the key to it, I think if I mention this 10 times a week on the air, it's not enough. The key to it is not externalizing and looking for more business outside. It's going from within, developing from within, building from within the current customers that you do have, the customer service, the ability for the people that you work with and around to feel vested in part of the business, that their performance causes the business to be what the business is. That is the real success today, and there's so many people who don't see it, and that, Harry, has got to do with leadership.
I love what you said about fostering an environment where the people in your organization take ownership and want to treat customers right, and they have a vested interest in winning. In my book, I talk about a simple principle. It's a 98-2 principle. I fundamentally believe that if a whole organization, if you feel like you have if the organization feels like there's a vision, there's purpose, they're going to be listened to, and they matter, and the work they're doing matters, 98% of them are going to do a good or a great job. 2% may try to be lazy or cheat you, but you know what? If you've got 98% of the people on your side, you are going to crush the competition.
Oh, absolutely. There won't be any competition when it really comes down to it. Oh, Harry, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It's harryscampbell.com, www.harryscampbell with S as Sam in the middle. And that's also where you can find a link to Amazon for Get Real Leadership. And I give all the proceeds from the book and all the speaking engagements I get from the book to brain cancer research, because I'm a big fan of giving back, and that has affected my family. So I welcome the opportunity to talk to people and engage with them.
Wonderful. By the way, we're going to have you back, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. At any given point in time, listen to the numbers. 45 million American women reach menopause. Those years leading up to this point are not always a picnic. And wouldn't it be great if women, their husbands, and also their kids could laugh their way through this transition armed with the knowledge that they need to optimize those years? Our guest, Robin Gordon, health consultant and the author of Hot Flashes, Marriage, Motherhood in the Menopausal Years. She's the one who talks about it, and she is the one who knows. And Robin, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, I'm a man. I've never gone through that. But I have been around women who have gone through that. And sometimes it's not really great to be around them during that period of time. But then again, too, I guess there's a way to look through it and enjoy that time.
Absolutely. You know, we're not the hot chicks anymore, but we're the hottest chicks, if you will, from hot flashes to lots of all kinds of things during this period. But it can be a time when women can become very well-grounded and really set the stage for the second part of their lives and have very fulfilling relationships with their husbands and or significant others and their children.
Now, by the way, what was it that triggered you? What caused you to put this particular subject matter to pen?
Great question. Well, I am a menopausal woman, and when I was going through changes, you know, typically, Michael, you've been around women who, you know, have been kind of probably hormonal around their menstrual period. So, you know, you say that maybe we'd have about 3 days that were kind of off or maybe moody. But when I had about 3 weeks that were kind of off and only 1 week on, that's when I realized something was changing.
Nothing.
I started to actually see myself in cartoons and started to chronicle some of, you know, what was going on inside of me into, you know, cartoon images. And clearly there's a real changing health picture around this period of time. Lots of things change from, obviously, your hormones. You get really tired, often moody, often gaining weight. Lots of sexual drive, sometimes get really hot. You've heard of those as hot flashes. So, you know, sure. Women may experience some or all of these kinds of symptoms, and I was one of those. So as a hormone victim, I decided to kind of do something about it, and I recorded all of these thoughts and did some research and created a book so women could sort of anticipate some of these rocky terrain and try to get themselves as well as they could and optimize their health.
I think that's the key, the word anticipate. You know, let's say I'm a woman and I'm just starting to go through those things, and I go through some of the things you were talking about, the hot flashes, the weight gain, fatigue, low sex drive, and all of those things that come with it. If I don't know what mm-hmm. to expect, it's going to hit me very hard, and I'm not going to know how to deal with it and handle it, and those people around me are going to get the worst of it. They're going to get the brunt of it. But if I'm going to anticipate it ahead of time, know what could happen and how I could be, then that gives me the choice. It gives me the option to take a little different look or in a different direction.
Absolutely. And the only thing out there, you know, Michael, was very academic books, which, frankly, I found to be kind of off-putting, and you didn't really fully understand that. I'm not coming from a medical background, so, you know, if you're every woman out there who was just trying to figure out what the heck is going on here and happened to be raising an adolescent at the time, which is a whole other story. But you know, there were changes in the way I felt about myself. Obviously, I wasn't getting as much sleep, and I'm sure a lot of women out there are in the same position. And really, I wasn't as available to my husband or to my child. So, you know, trying to anticipate that this may happen and knowing what to do. And that was really one of the reasons why I decided to write the book.
Now, by the way, when we talk about some of the health challenges, and there's a tremendous amount of health challenges that most people take for granted. Do they know a woman's going to be a certain age? She's going to have hot flashes. She's going to go through the change. She's going to have the menopause. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is. But if it's not handled correctly, what are we really dealing with? What kind of problems can we look at? Or what are some of the symptoms that would bring us to the awareness of those problems could be happening?
Well, a lot of women out there probably have some aches and pains that they didn't have before. And what can be happening is that the bone density starts to decrease with the estrogen, which is the hormone that decreases in women as they go through, you know, this transition. So what ends up happening is they're losing bone density, and if they don't get a bone density scan, which is a very easy instrument, and I talk about it in the book, you know, that's given pretty much at every gynecologist's office or every hospital has one of these machines, to find out, you know, if you are losing bone density, you need to either supplement that with calcium. There are certain amounts of calcium that you need to take, and it needs to be taken with, you know, vitamin D and magnesium, and only a certain amount of it can be absorbed at a certain time. So these are things that we don't typically know as women unless you are aware and can anticipate some of these changes. If it's too late, you've already lost a lot of that bone density, and then you're at risk for breaking bones and, you know, things like that. So better to get a handle on this this stuff early and do some preventative maintenance.
No, by the way, if you go through the blood pressure test, the screenings, the bone density, the colonoscopy, if you're 50 plus, you know, the pap smears mm-hmm. and then the mammograms, will they, if you're young enough, will they help you move through that menopausal period if you are physically in the best condition that you could be in?
Absolutely. And speaking of the best physical condition, the other thing that most women experience is weight gain around this time. All of a sudden, their waist seemed to disappear. I know mine did, and it was a time when I decided that I was going to try and get that back. Probably the best decision I ever made, because what I learned is that getting yourself into a good, what they call body mass index, which I also talk about in my book, and there's a chart in there so women can find out where they're supposed to be, is one of the best things you can do to prevent disease and to prolong your life, essentially. Having what they call a body mass index of 25 or lower is actually a marker for good health and longevity. And I wasn't aware of this, but it really is a great idea to work out a little bit more. We tend not to be as active because we're tired during that period of time, and yet that's the very time when we need to get active and try to build a lean muscle mass so that we can metabolize and keep burning calories. So there's lots of reasons why these things are happening, and again, women don't, you know, typically know what's going on. It's just all of these changes kind of come at once. So getting a handle on that and, you know, really paying attention to your health obviously can minimize the risk of disease. Clearly, heart disease is the big one. And, well, we hear lots of things about cancer for women, and actually heart disease is the number one killer of women in our country. So it's real important that we're aware.
No, by the way, in getting into the intimacy and marriage end of this also, I mean, that could cause a tremendous amount of divorces if people don't know what's going on. And you can't put the full blame, quote unquote, on the woman if she's going through all of this. She's not going to be quite as calm and have her ability to deal with what goes on, you know, within the relationship. Because I can imagine the menopause would make you, you know, very ready to go off at the drop of a hat. And Susie Greenman,
yeah, I'm sure you've experienced that.
Right, Radio Susie, Susie Greenman sitting over on the other side of this desk going, she said, I never right. did it. I was fine to the whole thing. Yeah. Okay, she's shaking her head yes now. Okay, but yeah. I can imagine you would have a problem if you're not prepped for it. And the other side of that, if I'm thinking about this now, we could be talking to women about this, having them anticipate, realizing the full scope of the consequence of what could possibly happen if you don't take care of yourself. But there should be a book for men or a handbook that says this is what to look forward to, this is what you may have to deal with, and this is what to help your wife with. So it's got to be a two-sided street. Not two-sided where, you know, you're taking anybody's side, but it's two sides where they're both moving in the same direction, focusing on the same end result to keep that woman sane during this period of time and keeping her marriage and her family together.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've had a number of husbands read this book. So if there's any men listening out there and you're kind of going, what happened to my, you know, what happened to my partner here, you know, the sweet, loving woman who I married, you might want to grab a copy of this, because a lot of the husbands have said, now I get what's going on. What you're looking at in the book, in Hot Flashes, which is the name of the book, is a series of cartoons, essentially, about what's going on in the woman's mind while she's going through all of these changes. And so it's really like opening up a window, you know, for the men. And it also obviously has, you know, it's kind of like a primer. So it's talking about, you know, well-researched changes that are happening. But it's done in kind of a humorous way so that anybody, man, you know, or woman, could pick this up and really get a sense of, you know, some of the things, as you said, to anticipate what's going on. You know, an interesting thing, Michael, is that people aren't aware of is, I always talk about, you know, the B word for women during this time. It's like my wife turned into a B. And what's really happening is there's a chemical in the brain called oxytocin. Interesting chemical, what's called the caretaking chemical. And when women are of childbearing years, they have a fair amount of this. It's a chemical that actually causes them to want to nurture their child. So what ends up happening is, as the estrogen is decreasing, women lose some of this oxytocin in the brain, and what ends up happening is they become more self-centered, literally. And it's sort of a survival because obviously you've got a lot of, you know, physical changes. It's important that women attend to these. But it's also important that men understand that this is, you know, not only physically happening, but there's a chemical change in the brain. And it causes women to become a little bit more self-focused and a little less apt to bite their tongue, if you will, you know, or to say, sure, I'll be that, or, you know, all of a sudden everything becomes kind of overwhelming. And,
and a lot
of women feel really overwhelmed.
Yeah, and we're just about running out of time, but one of the things that I've learned over the years in communication, that one way to the B word is to say when they become a female dog.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Close.
The listeners probably know what I'm talking about by the B word.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Now, by the way, do you have a website we could find you at?
I do. It's www.hotflashesforwomen.com. That's the plural, WOMEN.com. The book is available on the website or through Amazon.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. And I think when you really come down to it, what you're saying makes so much sense. And there's so many women who walk into it, have no idea what they're getting into. Yet it's one of those things that you've got to go through. And so thank you so much for joining us. And I've appreciated your time, Robin.
You're so welcome. Thank you, Michael.
Good night.
Bye.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah. I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. 888-429-5471. That's the magic number to call if you want to join us at any time during the show.
It's me that you adore for now and evermore. That's all.
David Cope with us and his wife provide two-hour workshops in creating partnerships at home and at work. An entrepreneur whose pioneering prepaid legal business made him a nationally known expert. He's a motivational speaker and a certified world-class speaking coach. He is the author of Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, The Life Story of a Very Lucky Man. David's appeared in Good Morning America and radio shows all across the country. David, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, David, when we talk about cancer, define it. And I don't mean the physical, medical, whatever it is, but cancer for you. What is cancer?
Well, as most of your listeners and myself were growing up, when we first heard about cancer, it was a death sentence. As a matter of fact, it was not even discussed in polite company. But so many changes have taken place that it's no longer a death sentence. You have a much longer survival rate, if not even some cure rates with certain types of cancers, and they keep getting better. But for me, it absolutely turned my life upside down in a very, very good way. The first and foremost, when people have a problem with the title of my book, I ask them, have you read it? And they say, no. And I say, well, the first thing that happens when you have cancer, you get a full body bone scan and a full body tissue scan to see if it has metastasized anywhere else. And when they did that with me, they found a massive pulmonary embolism just waiting to break loose. That's the one that drops you over dead, just like that. You don't even get to say goodbye. And because they found it, they raced me into the emergency room, placed a filter in the vena cava. 9 days later, it broke loose. The filter caught it. I'm still alive. Without cancer, I would not be here today.
Okay, now, by the way, I really believe in my heart of hearts, everything has its reason, its purpose. We fall down, we get up, we fall down, we get up. But there are times when a debilitating disease could be the best thing and just happen to you that could have ever happened to you. First off, it makes your life completely come together, and because at that stage of the game, you look at your life and you say, what was it? What do I not want to do anymore? And if you got the guts, you move through the disease, and you go on to do whatever you're going to do. I think there's two kinds of people who get cancer. There is the patient who maybe for that year or so when they've been diagnosed with that's how much longer you've got to live, that the only time in their life they've ever gotten that kind of attention, so they're willing to die for it. Then you get somebody like yourself who gets it and says, okay, what can this do for me? Where am I going to go with it? How is this going to build on my life? And then all of a sudden you've got somebody who had more coming out than they did going in.
Absolutely. You know, for the readers of my book, what we really look for them to get, it's not a story about cancer. It's a story about helping you, the listener, live the life that you truly desire today. Because it, for me, was a wake-up call. And the people who have something to live for have a much higher chance of surviving cancer or any other major illness. And those who don't, those who want to wallow in the sorrow and take the gifts that those people are giving, they're going to be gone quicker than the rest of us. So okay, we want people to live the life they desire today.
David, let's look at the medical community. We have allopathic medicine, chemicals, you know what they're doing today. That's the conventional. And then we have the traditional medicines that people, you know, they came from, well, let's look at chemicals came from plants, et cetera. And there's both kind of medicines. The conventional doctors, the practitioners, what did you find them like?
Well, it's not a very warm community. You're just another number on a scanner and a little tab that goes on your wrist, and there's no warmth whatsoever. I had treatment in two different facilities, and the difference between those two facilities was night and day. The second facility had a holistic approach to it, and they treated you like a human being, and they cared about the whole body, not about that one particular medical issue. What a difference that makes.
Yeah, where was that? Where was the second one at?
The second one was Salem Hospital in Salem, Oregon. The first one was the OHSU in Portland, a very renowned medical facility. They do great medicine, but that they don't deal with people.
I remember somebody telling me a story at one time. He had cancer. He had lung cancer, and the doctor that diagnosed the lung cancer basically told him he had so much time to live, and he made it through. It was, you know, 5-6 years later, he ran into the doctor at the airport, and he said, look, I'm still alive 5 years later. And the doctor looked at him as though he was disappointed because his diagnosis wasn't right. It's a very interesting thing that people with cancer go through.
It is indeed. The first 9 months of my diagnosis and beginning treatment, every single medical facility we went to, they said, get your affairs in order because you're going to be gone before the end of the year. We're sorry, there's nothing we can really do for you. And had I listened to them, I would have missed out on some of the most joyous parts of my life that I've ever experienced. At the time of my diagnosis, my son was 6. I was a single dad, and I had sole custody. He was just coming up on his 7th birthday. He's now 12. 3 years ago, I met the love of my life, the only time in my life I've had a true partner. I've had good relationships and bad relationships, just like many of your listeners out there. But I've never had a true partner before, and that's why I am so happy to have been given these extra years. What a blessing.
Now, by the way, you know, we got Valentine's Day coming up. What makes this relationship of yours different from the past relationships?
Well, most folks are what we call romantically impaired. They really don't know how to make it work because they don't understand that men and women think completely differently. Women expect men to think like they do, just in a hairy version, and men expect women to think like they do, just in a softer version, and it doesn't work that way. It comes from instinct. It's thousands and thousands of years of human animal where we respond. We just respond. Somebody says something, we respond without thinking. And what we teach in our classes is human spirit, and that's by responding by choice.
Okay, now, by the way, the classes, did the classes come after your experience with cancer?
Yes, they absolutely did. When I was determined I wasn't going to die, like the doctors had predicted, I wanted to make the best of my life, and I wanted to know what could I share. And I wanted to share the messages that I learned. And I did that first by writing the book, Cancer, It's a Good Thing I Got It, The Life Story of a Very Lucky Man. And then my wife and I decided that we should share what we learned about relationships. And we have a class. It's 8 series of classes. And the best way for your listeners to understand it, Michael, is it's like getting the operations manual for the other people in your life. And most folks have never had that before. As a matter of fact, we didn't even know it existed, but now it does. And they can learn more about that if they want by going to somedaygroup.com, and they can also sign up for our free relationship newsletter if they'd like to learn more about it.
Okay, that's S-O-M-E, somedaygroup.com.
That's right, because everybody says, someday I'm going to do this, or someday I'm going to do that, and someday never comes, and nor do we know. You know, I just got back from a speaking engagement in Las Vegas where I was the keynote speaker, and I went a little early and met with a lot of the association members who were in attendance, and I looked them all up and down, and none of them, not a single one of them, had the major characteristic of a milk carton. They weren't a milk carton. What I mean by that is there was no expiration date printed on them anywhere. None of us knows when our time is up. So if there's someone you love, you should tell them today. If there's a passion that you want to achieve, what are you waiting for? Do it today, because none of us knows when our time is up.
Wouldn't it be interesting if you could live every day of your life, as though midnight was the last day of your life? It was all over at midnight. Be interesting what we would worry about or what we wouldn't worry about, and the way that we would look at life.
Well, and that's a gift that I have been given. It's an absolute gift I've been given. Each day that I wake up and I'm not dead, I think that's a good day. And no matter how much pain I'm dealing with that day, whether it's a good day or a bad day, I make the most of that day as if it was my last. And
okay,
we never go to sleep. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was going to say, what do you think it is that people in relationships, what do you think that wedge is between the two of them? Is there an overarching theme when couples come into your workshops that you see, or even if they're single as individual, that you see that there's a wedge? Where is that wall between men and women that you have seen to stop them from having that relationship that you're talking about?
Well, one of the biggest things that we found is most of the people who are unhappy in relationships are unhappy because they're not getting something that they want. And the main reason they're not getting what they want is they don't know how to ask for it. They don't know a good ask. And that's critically important, that you explain to them, explain to your partner, this is what I need from you. And this is what it would look like for me if you did it. And ask them, are you open to providing this to me? And if they say yes to that, then you need to ask them, what do you need to give me what I need? Is there anything I have to help you with? Is there any components that you need to provide that for me? And by communicating on a clear and direct basis like that, it eliminates 75% of all the concerns.
No, absolutely. And if you go in with honesty, and I would venture to guess there are people who will sit down and they will ask those questions of each other, and one of them is not going to be honest. And that lack of honesty, that authenticity, is going to cause the relationship to go right down the tubes. That's going to have to be something where somebody asks that. They cannot put pressure on the other person for what kind of an answer they're going to get, or once they do get an answer, to justify it in their own way and to dilute it in any way, shape, or form. That's going to take a lot of guts for two people to sit there, because if the other person doesn't like what you're hearing, they better come out now than 5 years from now when it could be a disaster.
Well, and you're speaking right to it. What happens with couples is they, one or the other, sometimes both, contort themselves to present what they think the other person is looking for. They contort themselves to give the answers they think the other person is looking for. And that may work in the short term in order to get somebody in your life for a little while, but sooner or later, both sides are going to find out who you really are. So wouldn't it be smarter just to be honest and yourself up front so that you can get a relationship, a long-term, loving, caring partnership like I have now, rather than just a mate in your bed for a few months?
Honesty. Oh, the H word. I don't know if I can deal with this. Maybe a little Prozac would help you with it. David, we're just about out of time. Again, please, with your website.
Yes, that would be www.somedaygroup.com, and you can download chapters of the book and sign up for the free relationship newsletter.
Wonderful. And by the way, the relationships, they go on where? If somebody wanted to come to a workshop?
That information is on the website. We do them all around the country, and we also have some MP3 download and DVDs coming out soon.
Wonderful. Hey, David Cope, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thank you, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you. Good night.
The curtains falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it